Hi, welcome to Folkcraft. I'm Temperance.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're going to be talking about bioregionalism and seasonal shifts and how you can kind of, you know, relate to that and work through it and be part of your natural landscape and still be witchy and still be pagan and still be all the things that you want. But guess what? Maybe it doesn't have to be Yule just because it's December. Ooh. So here we go. We're going to break into it. So I think we should start with a very brief definition just so that we're all in the same playing field of I don't use the term, so I'm going to let you define it. I'm going to probably define a different term, but you use the term bioregional animism. So what do you define that as?
So bioregional animism is the concept of applying animism, the idea that all things contain spirit, and focusing that lens on the bioregion you reside in. So the term bioregion can be a little confusing because it's a pretty large area, but oftentimes bioregional animists are focusing on their particular ecosystem and how it interacts with their surrounding area. So in America, we might focus on the town we live on and the state we live in kind of broadly. So bioregional animism looks at the shifting of spirits through the area that you live in, because you can have multiple ecosystems within the wider bioregion.
So I think it's important to also note that animism is the general belief that most organic things contain a spirit. I would argue that animism does not include all things, does not include all inorganic things. That is an argument that I would make. But the general consensus is that, you know, most things do contain a spirit. That is the general definition of animism. So the belief in bioregional animism really relates to nature and land spirits and, you know, structures and things within structures. And so that's a, you know, broader, kind of more condensed definition.
And I would also add that it does, when we talk about the landscape, we are also including like human constructed domiciles. So cities and towns are just as much full of spirit and residing within ecosystems as like a cypress slough or a mangrove swamp. So I think that's also really important because a lot where I live, for instance, the town and these quote unquote natural spaces, they're all kind of jigsawed next to each other and intersect in interesting ways. And a lot of us oftentimes will be in this kind of in-between space where we exoticize this kind of idea of the wild. And it makes it harder for us to appreciate things like our house spirits, the spirits of the roads and concrete and things like that. So I do just want to, like, defend the city animism.
It is real. It's there. But, you know, a lot of people, when they come into folk magic and they separate it, because this is what I've noticed, is over the past few years, the community has shifted in a way where they've decided, I'm not Wiccan. Right? You know, and people come into the community often through the lens of Wicca, which is fine. That's pretty normal. But they're saying, well, I'm not Wiccan. I don't agree with this. I'm going to go practice XYZ. And there's a lot of people, it's kind of in vogue right now, falling into folk magic. And so folk magic is having this kind of renaissance moment where we're bringing it back. And people are like, okay, well, I'm a folk witch, or I'm a practitioner, or I'm XYZ. What do I do when it's Yule? What am I doing at Samhain? Are these things that are recognized within folk magic? And I think there's a really important thing that we have to discuss and we have to unpack, is that folk magic exists separately of religion. Folk magic is not a religion. It's a practice. And so you can carry in any religious or spiritual practices, traditions, ideas, concepts that you want to, and you can overlay it on top of the magic that you're practicing, but you don't have to let go of those things if you don't want to.
Yeah, and folk magic oftentimes comes to us through a Christian lens or through a syncretic lens. So the blending of traditional beliefs. And outside of that, it also comes from the need to exist. And I would often say that the need to exist is the core of things. Even if, for instance, because a lot of the folk magic that I learned, either just through observational things, because I don't come from a quote-unquote magical family, I come from a Southern Baptist family, but there was quite a lot of magic thrown in there. The religion was there, but the need to use that magic to survive was like a patina over the religion, if that makes sense. So there is a secular aspect, there is a religious aspect, and at its core, it all comes down to cultural context, which I think is really important in folk magic. It's born of so many different elements, and you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater just because you don't have to throw it out just because you're kind of maybe evolving and realizing like, oh, I am not Wiccan, but this is my initial gateway. And I do like, maybe you do really like Yule. There's not really a reason not to celebrate it. Yule is also very complicated because Wicca's relationship with holidays is very strange and kind of piecemeal and could take a long time to discuss.
Well, I think it's important. We're just, you know, we're going to give it a side note. And there's many resources that you can read about this concept. Plug myself. I know Year of the Witch does discuss it. But really go back further. If you're really genuinely curious, why are these holidays on the wheel? Read Gerald Gardner's work. Mm-hmm. Figure out what they were doing in the 50s and 60s and really kind of like divulge into what were they doing and why were they doing it. And you're going to begin to quickly realize that it's a lot less mystical and spiritual and a lot more community oriented. And when we talk about holidays in general, that's a lot of the reason that holidays are even celebrated is because it brings people together. And paganism is no different. The holidays are meant to gather people together and see people and communicate and talk and have a good time. So yeah, there's this kind of issue with the wheel in that people think it's this super long-standing magical thing that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years and really hasn't even been around for 100 years.
No.
But that doesn't invalidate it. If you find, you know, strength and power in it, then go ahead and go for it. But just because it's on the Wiccan wheel doesn't mean you have to celebrate it. Now, there is a note in there about some of these days are astrological. And so, yeah, we're doing solstices and equinoxes. No, you can't change the day of the solstice and the equinox, but the overlaid cultural holiday on top of that, right? So we can separate the winter solstice is a separate event from Yule. Those are two different things. And so you can really pick apart those things and determine when they do and don't start for you and in your practice.
Right, and I think that's the whole idea of understanding how these seasons are shifting, how these tides are moving for you as a practitioner. Because while these holidays that we're so familiar with in the pagan sphere, and it's very like saturated almost, there's kind of this dominant over culture, it isn't the end all be all. And if it doesn't apply to you, if it doesn't speak to you, you're no less of a practitioner because you don't want to do those things or engage with them because they have less influence or context for you.
Yeah. So I'm curious about you. I know we had, when we discussed how we were going to do this episode, we had talked about, you know, giving exercises, but I think in an even better way than explaining how to do it is showing how we do it.
Yeah.
So what are you doing to kind of acknowledge the passing of time, the seasons and the holidays? How are you doing that in real life?
So I'm a big fan of case studies, right? So my case study would be that I live in Florida and we do not experience the four traditional seasons. Temp, I know you're familiar with that for anyone outside of it. So we don't have, in terms of like,
we don't have any seasons. Let's be real. Florida scientifically only has, most of Florida scientifically only has two seasons. It's wet and dry.
Yep. So we have the wet and hot season. This is where we're more prone to storms. This is also colloquially referred to as hurricane season. And then we have the dry, cool season, which is very easy for me to tune into because in addition to being a witch, I'm also a Celtic Reconstructionist. So a two-part year is very, very familiar to me. And then living here and just kind of surviving summer, which is dry season, or wet season rather, I'm very familiar.
The wet isn't bad. The wet isn't as bad as the heat. It's the hotness that gets you.
And then they combine into this beautiful thing called humidity. And you just swim your way from place to place through the air. So I am not observing any shifting between the four seasons. I'm not celebrating any kind of cross, like, spring holidays, really. I'm observing the shifting of wet season and dry season. Normally, what I'm taking the shift from is environmental cues. So I don't have, like, a set day where I'm celebrating and excited about the shift into wet season. I'm just kind of living my life, and I'll notice, oh, it's the first storm of the season. And I have things kind of set aside that have this natural event, which signals to me, like, oh, we're about to move from this time period where everything has been dry and kind of more asleep. We're going to go into this time period where everything is getting stirred up. Things are going to get a lot more volatile. We're going to have the heat increasing. And I kind of just welcome it. So my actual practice, when we see the storm rolling in after this long stretch of dry, me and my husband kind of camp in for the night. We put a pot of tea on, and we sit outside, and we watch the storm rolling in, we watch the rain come down, listen to the thunder and lightning. And I do have a little bit more of a structured aspect of this, which is I make palmetto manuscripts. So what this is, and this is all UPG, or unverified personal analysis. These are things that I was drawn to do from spirit through my manipulation and working with plants as well. So I will take palmetto frond, and I will strip it down and get about 2 inch tall by 5 to 6 inch wide strips. And I will treat them, dry them, and then keep them clamped up for a number of weeks, sometimes months, until they're completely dry of moisture. And I will puncture them and then write down the slats a certain hymn or story that associates with a particular event. So during these shifting seasons, I actually will have this palmetto manuscript that I'll open up, and I'll go through and kind of read the associated story as a welcome to the wind and the storm that's coming in. When dry season comes, it's pretty much the same thing. A cold front will come in, and I call it the first chill of the season, as opposed to the first storm. And the night of is the same, but we actually draw it out for a few days, because normally when we have a cold front come through, it's a few, and I should also preface, a cold front for us means like it's 70.
It's like 60 out.
Yeah. Oh, 60 would be a blessing, but normally it's like 70. So what this means for us, because normally it is oppressively hot. The sun is a deadly laser. It is oppressively hot. So when these chill fronts come through, the first chill, that first night, again, we're sitting out in the patio, we're drinking tea, I'm reading a little bit of a hymn or a poem out of a palmetto manuscript, and then for the several days after, we're traveling. We're going to Myakka State River, we're going to the Everglades, we're spending time outside. And it's not a huge, like, I'm going to directly connect and talk to a god or leave offerings at these places. It is going and just being there, being present in the moment, and being grateful for this shift. So those are the two kind of minor shifts that I observe. And I also celebrate two bigger periods of times that are marked by a lot more ceremony, right? And that's the breeding season for the Florida panther, and the time after which most panthers have given birth. And so this is something that was very much born out of... So for those of you that don't live in Florida, the Florida panther is an incredibly endangered animal. Back in the 70s, there were about 40 individuals in the wild. Through a lot of efforts from a lot of different organizations and tribal activism and conservatism and breeding programs, there are now about 200 Florida panthers south of Okeechobee, most of them concentrated to the around the area that I live, a little further south and a little more to the east. But they're keystone animals. They're incredibly important. And they face a lot of danger primarily from motorists. And it's really, really often ignored how important it is for people who do not live here full time but decide to come down during winter and just ignore things. They're often the ones that cause the deaths of these animals. So during breeding season, I will, again, have a palmetto manuscript and have a much bigger ritual where I'm doing a series of fertility rites for the panthers and raising my own spirits, raising my own energy to encourage fertility amongst the panthers throughout breeding season. And then towards the end of breeding season, I shift those efforts towards protective work. And that can include even going out to panther crossings and putting up protective, biodegradable, safe protective measures, whether that be powders or particular sachets, where we find that a lot of panthers, unfortunately, attempt to cross a highway and will get hit. We call these panther crossings, and normally you have to drive slower, and a lot of people, unfortunately, ignore that because they're impatient. So I will do a lot of work from starting now. Actually, December is the start of breeding season, and up until March, doing continuous work throughout this. So those are my examples of ways in which I'm looking at my environment. I'm paying attention to the breeding season for an incredibly important animal who represents kind of the heart of my area. And I'm also paying attention to the meteorological shifts, the way in which our seasons change, rather than trying to force some kind of like outdated model that just doesn't make sense for me. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at what's actually happening. Because I felt very pressured coming into things. Again, I definitely came in through pop culture and Wicca as my foray into what it meant to be an animist or a pagan. And so it meant like, oh, I guess these are the eight things that I do. And I just, it didn't resonate. And it took me a long time and a lot of just watching and listening to scientists and learning more about my area to develop my observances. What are the things that I want to observe? What are the things that are just, hey, I see you, I acknowledge you, I acknowledge this shift in the weather, and what is the, oh, we need to actively do our part to protect in an advocacy way, but also in a magical way during the natural rhythms of the animals around. What about you?
I spend a lot of time listening for the sound of death And that guides a lot of what I do. So if you live in the north, so let's say you live in New England, okay, and I say to you, hey, like, what time of year do the leaves fall on your trees? You'd be like, oh, probably like October or November. Well, I live in Florida, and so our leaves fall in April, and literally it just so happens that the trees at some point in the spring, they decide, we didn't drop any leaves, I guess we should drop some, and then they just drop leaves. They don't turn colors or anything like that. Like, trees just kind of shed off some of the leaves that are kind of dead. And so that's some of the cues that I look for. I look for that. I look for big changes. I have a, I believe the term is barometric pressure.
Like a barometer?
Yeah, I have a gauge, like an old boat gauge on my wall. And so that will signal things for me. Comes in super handy during like hurricanes. I've had it since I was a kid. Like it's an antique now, but it still works. I will feel when it gets kind of way humid, when it gets dry, when it gets cool, anytime there's a significant shifting in my local climate. But reeling it back into the death, I do look for kind of the mini deaths, because every time we have a change, anytime we have a shift, anytime it gets colder, hotter, wetter, drier, we end the cycle of one part of the year and we enter the next cycle. And in that change becomes the death of the old and the birth of the new. And so as the kind of natural world is experiencing that, the spirit world around us is experiencing it too. And so I work super heavily with certain particular land spirits. And so I recognize when it gets really, really hot, I may need to water more throughout my garden, throughout my yard. I may need to give some of my trees more attention or more fertilizer. When it gets really, really rainy, they drain some of the canals. And so those are significant things for me. I would say shark season is super significant for me when shark season occurs. And we also have, you know, certain fruit seasons. So like avocado season is super important to me, mango season, oranges, strawberries, things of that nature. And so I'm really looking for the cues in the natural world around me. And I think it's important to note that every single year, what I'm doing changes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there's anything wrong to say that. I think that your practice should be changing and should be evolving with you. Every year I re-identify, what are my priorities? What's important to me? What has changed around me? What can I do to help the spirits around me, my natural environment, my household, and kind of identifying what's important, what's not, prioritize it on the list. If you want to include secular holidays, include those holidays. But if you want to also add in religious holidays, and you can, you know, I'm going to say it and people are going to maybe disagree with me, you can mix in the religious holidays that you choose. So maybe you grew up Christian and you don't want to give up Christmas because it holds sentimental value to you. No one's saying that because you're a big bad pagan now that you have to give up Christmas. You can celebrate secular Christmas without celebrating religious Christmas. You can keep some of those old things. So you get to determine on your ritual year, your festival year, what is important to your practice, because no one practices your practice but you. And so I take a look at what's important to me and I readjust it every year.
I think that's really critical, especially talking about cultural holidays are just their own thing. And there's no reason to stop doing them if they still resonate. I celebrate Christmas. That is one of my favorite holidays. I am too queer not to be obsessed with any excuse to truss up my entire house in tinsel. And we theme our Christmases. It's a big deal every single year. This year, it's mod and birds. Everything is either 50s turn of the century mod or mid-century, not turn of the century. Or birds. I love Halloween. It's one of my favorite days of the year. And that's very different from Samhain.
I'm not giving up Halloween. You can't make me. I won't.
No. I dress up every year. It might be a lazy costume, but I dress up every year. And I still celebrate my religious holidays, which for me are Christmas a little bit. Christmas still has a little bit of a religious tinge for me because I grew up Southern Baptist. It's really important to my family. I don't necessarily believe in the religion, but there's still something there for me. My husband is Puerto Rican, and connecting to his roots through Three Kings Day is important. As a Southern person, New Year's is a huge deal for me. I make collards and cornbread and black-eyed peas every single time. My husband thinks it tastes nasty, but he eats it anyway because he also grew up eating it. And you eat those things for wealth, good luck, and money in the new year if you're not.
Nothing can be worse than the dinner I made tonight. Like, I'm just going to say it. Nothing could be. Let me just break into a super serious podcast and tell you what I made for dinner, okay? So, like, I'm not the greatest. I'm a really good baker. I'm not a great cook, okay? And so I was like, yeah, I'm really hungry, but I'm trying to be frugal, so I'm not going to order Uber Eats. Let me just look at what I've got in the cabinets. So I found a bunch of cans that I had, and so I was like, I can put these in the pressure cooker. So I put a can of corn, a can of black beans. So it sounds good at this point, right? Then I took a turn for the worst. I was like, artichoke hearts? Why not? Just throw these in there too. Put in a can of artichoke hearts, and then I put in a can of cream of chicken soup, and then I put in two frozen chickens from my freezer, and I put it on the pressure cooker, and it, you know what, I've made worse, but barely. Like, this was pretty bad. My partner still ate it all because they didn't want to see me cry about it, but your collards can't be worse than what I served tonight.
First of all, my collards are delicious, actually. Everyone else in my life begs for me to bring them in. My husband just hates collards in general. It is a very acquired taste. But I think your partner should be canonized for their sacrifice.
You know, you want to hear this? The sacrifice? This is, I might even cut this part. This might be patrons only. If public hears it, then I was feeling in a good mood when I edited. But one night I said, I'm going to make fettuccine Alfredo. I told him, I was like, I'm going to make chicken Alfredo. And I go downstairs and I'm starting to set up. I put the pasta on the stove. That was my first mistake. I didn't look for any other ingredients at this point. I only put the pasta on the stove. I thought we had everything else. So I go to get the chicken. Well, we don't have chicken. And so I started going through my cabinets like, what do I have? Because I've already told this man that I'm making chicken Alfredo. So I found a can of corned beef hash.
No.
This could be a chicken substitute. No, this could be a chicken substitute. So I'm like, okay, I'll just start frying it up, right? That's like the good Irish in me. I was like, I'm just going to start frying this up. So I put it in the pan, and the pasta's going. So I'm like, okay, well, I have to make the Alfredo sauce. So I get the pot out, and I look in my fridge for cream, which I could have sworn we had. We didn't. We had half and half, though. And so I thought to myself, well, I can substitute cream for half and half because half and half is just half cream, half skim milk. So it'll be fine. And so then I went to get the Parmesan, but we didn't have Parmesan. We had cheddar cheese. And so I Googled, can you make fettuccine Alfredo with cheddar cheese? And someone on Google said that you could. So I put the cheddar cheese in the Alfredo sauce, which at this point was just boiling half and half, and it put the cheddar cheese in it. And so I made this, and then I was like, okay, well, it's time for me to put the fake chicken into the Alfredo sauce. So I put
corned beef hash. That is not fake chicken. That is a very different food.
I put the corned beef hash into the cheddar Alfredo sauce, and then I put that onto the pasta, which was not fettuccine. It was skinny spaghetti. And then I served it with a serious face. And it was like, here, this is what we have for dinner. And guys, readers, we have money. I could have gone to the grocery store. I was just being lazy. So I served this man this thing, and he's like, what is this? And I was like, it's chicken alfredo.
You have the audacity to put poor Robin on blast for her vegan quiche.
Look, that vegan quiche is an atrocity. There's no eggs in it. But there was no chicken alfredo. Oh my
god, and chicken alfredo is just sanctified.
Robin, if you're listening, this is your comeback story.
Oh my lord.
Some tears came out on that one, but
you just made me feel so much better about being a bad cook because I've never done that.
Look, I just thought that we could improvise and overcome.
Which is cute.
Gaslight, gatekeep, girl boss. I thought it was going to work out.
You gaslit yourself. You were gatekeeping chicken. You girl bossed nothing.
I girl bossed too close to the sun for that one. It was bad, yeah. So... That is our episode on bioregionalism. I hope you guys enjoyed it. If you want to support the podcast, we have a Patreon.
If you want to support the podcast, then you should get Temperance things for her pantry.
Go fund me, please. Support our Patreon so I can buy food. Where can the people find you, Aaron?
I don't know anymore. God is dead. No, I can be found at Aaron Oberon on Instagram, and that's it. And you can find my book in places where you find books.
And I'm Temperance Alden, and you can find me everywhere except Twitter, because that's a hell site, and I'm not on it. But maybe by the time this podcast airs, I'll be back on it. But as of today, we're recording mid-December, I decided that I quit Twitter, so I'm not there. But you can find me everywhere else. My book, Year of the Witch, is available everywhere books are sold. Thanks for listening.